Now, for those keeping track at home, we're only 33 days away from the general election. The polls show the presidential candidates are in a tight race as we head into November, although Hillary Clinton seems to be picking up steam after the presidential debate.
We also saw the two vice presidential candidates duke it out on the stage last night. They showed a very different debate compared to their counterparts last week. But how much do VP debates really matter?
Harry Enten joins us now. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So after that first presidential debate, we still got a couple more, but we saw the first one, and the big question was, is this going to make a difference to voters? And so far, what is your answer to that question?
For the first presidential debate, absolutely seems to have made a difference to voters. Now, there is some question as to how exactly it made a difference, but we have certainly seen in both the swing state surveys and the national surveys that Hillary Clinton has picked up some steam. For instance, in our 538 polls only model, she was only at about a 55% to perhaps 60% chance of winning the election before the first debate, and she's now up to a 75% chance of winning the election. So clearly there has been movement in her direction, and the first debate definitely seems to have benefited her.
Looking at presidential debates in the past, is there a lot of volatility around them that, you know, kind of like the conventions, that there might be a big bump and then things kind of settle back to where they were? Or do you think this is the kind of polling that could stick for a while?
Well, you mentioned the conventions, and I think that it's, you know, this is a decent parallel insofar as that sometimes the bumps stick and sometimes they do not. You know, if you go back 4 years ago, Mitt Romney seemed to have gotten a bump out of the first debate, but that really didn't seem to stick, and Barack Obama ended up winning the election rather easily, even if the margin was decently close. But sometimes, you know, you go back to, say, the 1980 debates between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. And Reagan did very well in that debate, and he ended up carrying that bump through election day and was able to beat him. So I'm not sure whether or not this bump will stick, but the thing to keep in mind was Hillary Clinton led going into the first debate, and she had a wider lead coming out of the first debate. So for Donald Trump to really have a shot in this election, he's not only going to need to do better in the second debate and third debate, he'll have to basically take back all of the bump that Hillary Clinton got and then even pile on a little bit more. It's a tough chore in front of him.
Well, one of the main things at the to-do list for both candidates was to reach out to those independents during that debate and sway them. Is there any evidence that those independents were, you know, turned in one direction or the other?
Well, I think the one thing that does seem to have happened is we do know that the third-party candidates, it does seem that they've seen a little bit of a drop-off in their numbers. You saw that specifically in the Quinnipiac polls that came out this past week in some key swing states, and those voters have tended to be independents in the past, those who have supported Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. So we do see some movement towards Hillary Clinton from those third-party people who said they were going to vote for a third-party candidate, which is good news for her, because if you had looked before the debate, she was certainly being hurt more by the third-party candidacies of Gary Johnson and Jill Stein.
Well, last night was the first and the only, it's worth pointing out, vice presidential debate. Definitely debate season right now. We had Indiana Governor Mike Pence on stage with the Democratic Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. And here's some highlights from that debate. We'll hear first from Governor Pence.
Hillary Clinton's top priority when she became Secretary of State was the Russian reset. The Russian reset. After the Russian reset, the Russians invaded Ukraine and took over Crimea. And the small and bullying leader of Russia is now dictating terms to the United
States. She was part of the team that got bin Laden, and she'll lead the team that will get Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS. Second, we got to disrupt financing networks. Third, disrupt their ability to recruit on the internet in their safe havens. But fourth, we also have to work with allies to share and surge intelligence. That's the Hillary Clinton plan.
I know you've historically opposed taxpayer funding of abortion, but Hillary Clinton wants to repeal the long-standing provision in the law where we said we wouldn't use taxpayer dollars to fund abortion.
These guys, and Donald Trump has said it, deportation force, they want to go house to house, school to school, business to business, and kick out 16 million people. And I cannot believe, six times tonight, I have said to Governor Pence, I can't imagine how you can defend your running mate's position on one issue after the next. And in all six cases, he's refused to defend his running mate's
position. No, don't put words in my mouth.
All right, as a sampling there of what was said last night from Tim Kaine and Mike Pence during the vice presidential debate. A lot of different topics covered there. Russia came up. Abortion came up, immigration policy. Harry, what stuck out to you from that sampling and last night in general?
Well, I think that the thing that really stuck out to me was that one person was trying to win a debate and the other person was trying to make the other candidate's party leader look bad. So Mike Pence, I think, by most people's standards, won the debate in the traditional sense. If you look at the post-debate poll that came from CNN, he won by a small margin. But Tim Kaine's main objective was to try and make, basically, if you look at the Clinton website today, they have an ad up in which they are basically trying to tie Pence inability to really defend Donald Trump and turn those into television advertisements. So there was clearly just a difference of opinion of how to handle each side. But what I should point out is that we know from the past that doing well in vice presidential debates does not in any way correspond to any polling bounce. So people got a good look at the vice presidential nominees for each party. But at the end of the day, doing bad or doing well last night just isn't going, in my opinion, to make a huge difference.
So the VP debate might not swing the needle at all toward either candidate, but are there other sort of intangibles that come out of them, do you think?
I think the question is, I've said this all along during this campaign, which is whichever candidate's name is in the news is bad news for that candidate. So the past week you've heard Donald Trump's name being in the news a lot after his poor performance in the first debate. Let's see how the news coverage carries it through the next few days, because at the end of the day, what's most important isn't the debates itself. It's how voters react to the debate, and how voters react to the debate is often tied to how the press covers it. So still not sure yet how that's exactly going to go. We'll see. But at the end of the day, if the vice presidential debate sort of leads the press coverage and it's bad news for Donald Trump over the next few days, then it perhaps could move the numbers, continue moving them in Hillary Clinton's direction, versus perhaps if it's, oh my God, Tim Kaine is inadequate, then those could move the numbers a little bit in Hillary Clinton's direction. But my guess is it was just a wash.
Harry Enten stays with us right now. We're talking about the latest from the campaign trail. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, and we're going to keep on talking with Harry in just a bit.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the vice presidential debate? What did you think about one or both of the candidates? Did anything happen there that's going to sway your vote? Do you think it's going to sway anyone's vote, or is this just sort of the sideshow? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the latest from the campaign trail with Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. And Harry, you know, we were talking about the vice presidential debate, saying it doesn't really matter in a sense, at least as far as moving the polling very much. I mean, in a sense, isn't that kind of a sad thing? These are two individuals who are, as they say, a heartbeat away from being president of the United States. Why don't we care more?
Oh, I think at the end of the day, we're voting for presidential nominees. I think that's what's going on. You know, it's kind of like saying, oh, I can't, Donald Trump says so-and-so might join his cabinet, and we generally don't expect much movement going on there. I think, if there was truly a disastrous performance, one in which someone truly showed themselves incapable of holding the office, then maybe you would see some movement. But, I just point out the thing that really makes me doubt that we'll ever see much movement coming out of the VP debate is you go back to 1988. That was when Lloyd Benson basically told Dan Quayle, sit down and go back to the kids' table, and telling him he's no Jack Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And the polls, in fact, moved in George H.W. Bush's direction. So I just don't think people are voting for vice presidential nominees, and that's why we don't see the polls move.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Paul joining us in Menominee Falls. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks. I'm a supporter of Tim Kaine. I was perplexed by his interrupting, and I was a little disappointed that he missed an opportunity when there was the back and forth on the nuclear issue, and Pence fired back that Ronald Reagan said that we shouldn't fight a nuclear war because it's unwinnable. And I was kind of talking to the TV and saying, well, we don't want to fight a nuclear war because it's immoral and it's destructive. It seemed like Kaine, who I'm a supporter of, seemed as if he had a checkoff list to go through. And yes, I think he was listening to Pence, but it was obvious to me that he had an agenda to attack Trump and what he was saying.
Got it, Paul. Thank you for that. Appreciate those responses. The first thing he said, they were talking over each other a lot of interrupting last night going on. And it sounds like you agree, Harry, that maybe Tim Kaine had an agenda, a to-do list, and that was maybe at the forefront instead of maybe responding in the moment. Is that going too far, or do you agree with that?
No, I agree with that. I agree with pretty much everything that caller just said, including talking to the TV. I do that very frequently. But, you know, look, that's exactly what was going on. Tim Kaine had an agenda going into this that was clear that they wanted to cut some, you know, some ads from it. You saw that from the Clinton campaign out this morning. I think Kaine recognized, look, I just can't turn in a disastrous performance. Beyond that, I have a game plan, and we're going to use this VP debate to basically make attack ads against Donald Trump, and that's exactly what happened.
So another narrative of this past week has been Donald Trump's taxes, and this also came up in the debate. Also in the New York Times over the weekend, here's a listen about what was said last night.
Donald Trump started this campaign in 2014. He said, if I run for president, I will absolutely release my taxes.
And he will.
He's broken his first promise. Second, he stood on
the
stage last
week. He hasn't broken his promise.
He stood on the stage last week, and when Hillary said you haven't been paying taxes, he said, that makes me smart.
So this has been billed as a bad week for Donald Trump, in part because of this tax issue by one suggestion, maybe Donald Trump has not paid taxes for 20 years, according to a few documents released to the New York Times. What do you think about that tax story?
I think it works for two reasons for Clinton. Yeah, I think it's a bad story for Trump, in large part because it reinforces one of two things that people believe about Trump. Either one, he cheats people out of their money while not paying very much of his own, which is one problem for him. Or two, Trump has made this entire run being about a good businessman, and I'm going to turn this economy around. And the fact is, if he was losing as much money as he indicated to the New York Times, upwards of $15 million, that indicates to perhaps that he's not such a good businessman. So both of those, it's a double hit against him. It's a type of story that really reinforces the negatives about him. And more than that, it just goes back to what I spoke about earlier. Every single day that that a certain nominee is leading the news is a bad day for that nominee, and Trump led the news on Saturday night because of that Time story, and he's led the news the past week because of the debate plus the Time story. It's just not good news for him.
And Harry, before we let you go, did you watch Saturday Night Live? They rolled out some new material with Alec Baldwin as Trump and Kate McKinnon as Clinton in the debate. What did you think?
Well, you know, I think that they're very good actors. And to be honest, SNL for me had its heyday. I am a younger guy in the 90s. I know for other people it was in the late 70s with the original cast. But I think whenever they're doing politics, they're doing a good job. And so I enjoyed it very much so.
Well, Harry, we'll talk to you next week.
You too.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. And he'll be back next week to give us the latest in national politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Well, the leaves are changing color, the sun is setting earlier, and the weather's getting colder. And to most of us, one of the best parts of fall is the disappearance of pesky summer bugs like mosquitoes.
While many insects die off in the winter, many types of spiders in Wisconsin don't die. The spiders have ways to survive the frigid weather. And I got to say, our producer, Amanda Magnus, fascinated by the spiders of Wisconsin.
Fascinated / obsessed.
We would have a weekly spider segment, I think, if we left it up to her. But we'll do the next best thing and talk about spiders in the winter now.
Mike Draney is here right now to tell us how spiders do it, what they do in the winter. He's a professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Robin, Veronica.
So this is kind of a mystery. It seems like other bugs over the winter months, they die. What happens to spiders?
Well, you know, the insects don't really die either, right? I mean, none of our insects except for the monarch actually leave Wisconsin. They're all here all the time. But, of course, a lot of insects survive the winter as eggs, and so they're basically gone. But spider eggs don't seem to have the ability to do that. So if it gets too cold, the spider eggs would just freeze, and then when they thaw, they would just turn to mush. So almost basically all of our spiders, you know, survive somehow as a spider through the winter. It's pretty amazing when you think that most of Earth's organisms cannot survive a Wisconsin winter. So they have to have special adaptations.
So what are some of the different tactics that spiders use since they can't do what a lot of insects do and just let their eggs propagate them through the winter? What do they do to stick around?
Yeah, so first of all, a lot of spiders do lay eggs in the you know, make their eggs in the fall. But people think that they lay around in the egg sac until the spring and then they hatch. But actually, the eggs immediately embryonate and the little baby spiderlings hang out in the egg sac through the winter. But all of the spiders, the immatures and the adults, they have to undergo a process of cold hardening. So nights like this, when it gets cold but it doesn't freeze, it sort of tells their body to start producing actually antifreeze compounds. they're very similar to the kind we put in our car, and they build these up in their tissues, and it lowers the temperature at which they freeze. And then they just behaviorally know they have to go to places that are sheltered so that it never gets too cold and they won't freeze. So they'll go into leaf litter or into cracks of bark. Or interestingly, a lot of spiders hang out in the space between snow and the ground, what's called the subnivian space. And it never gets much below freezing there, even though it might be minus 20, you know, above where we are. And so they actually survive the winter just hanging out there. They don't really care about the cold weather because, it, you know, they are always the same temperature as the environment, and they're pretty comfortable being cold. They just move a little slower, but they don't need as much food. But it's very important that they not freeze.
Wow, so you're almost making it sound like spiders have these superpowers. They have their own antifreeze, and they can just, you know, become winterized over the winter?
Yep, it's pretty amazing. They can survive much lower temperatures in the winter than they ever can in the summer. If you suddenly exposed them to cold temperature in the summer, they would be just like us. They would just get cold shock and die, but they have to get cold hardened.
Now, we humans have built a lot of environments, our houses, that could keep spiders warm through the winter. Are there ones that like to move inside with us?
Yeah, and that's the really important exception to the spiders that are, you know, have all these superpowers. There are certain species, a few species, that just live in our houses. And we moved them on accident from places farther south. And they cannot survive in Wisconsin except in the house. And so they're really just like us. They don't have any superpowers. They just hang out in your basement.
Which ones are those? Which ones are the non-superpower ones?
Well, the one that people are probably most familiar with are what is called a cellar spider. And so it's really long-legged, and it lives in a messy web kind of upside down. And that is, those are from caves in the Middle East originally, and they've just been moved all around the world. And they're even pretty far up into Canada now, but they only live in people's houses.
Talking to Mike Draney about the spiders of Wisconsin and what they do in the winter. He's with UW Green Bay at our Green Bay studio right now. Mike, I want to pause for a moment. And all this talk of spiders in our houses and spider egg sacs, people are maybe feeling a little icked out right now. Do you want to make a case that they shouldn't be? We should show a little love to the spiders?
Oh, absolutely. You know, they're an important part of our biodiversity. They're natural, native species. And they're really our friends because they're predators of insects mostly. So they're actually controlling numbers of a lot of other insects that might actually be pests to us. So if you allow one spider to live in your basement, in order to become an adult, it has to eat maybe 40 insects. And so that's 40 insects less that you'll have in total in your house. And the other thing I'll say is that spiders do not bite people very often. Most Wisconsin spiders actually can't bite people because they're too small. Spiders smaller than about a quarter of an inch really can't break human skin. And of the ones that can bite you, none of them attack you. They're only going to bite you if you are holding them in your hand or pressing against them. And of those, very few of them are poisonous. Really, the only one we have around here is the northern black widow, which I have found very few of. I've not actually collected one myself in Wisconsin yet, although people have brought them to me. So the chance that anyone's going to get bitten, I've not heard of anyone that's ever been bitten by a black widow.
And I know there are some spiders that pop up more in the spring, and you told us about a few of them before the show, and they all have these super interesting names. Wolf spider, jumping spider. The last one worries me a little bit, running spiders. Can you tell us about those three spiders?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, some spiders actually overwinter as immatures, and then right when it becomes spring, they turn into adults, and then they mate and have babies, and the babies grow up the following summer. And then they overwinter as immatures. And so those include the wolf spiders, and they're spiders that don't make webs. All of these spiders don't make webs. Instead, they run around, and wolf spiders actually carry the egg sac. The female carries the egg sac behind her on her spinnerets, you know, the silk glands. And so if you ever see a spider running around with a little white ball behind it, that's a wolf spider. Jumping spiders have really good vision, just like we do, and they're active in the daytime. And they pounce on their prey, just like a cat or something. And those are also mostly spring mating. And then lastly, there's ghost and sac spiders. And they're also spring mating, but some of them like to come inside they must like it when it's warm. And they make these little sleeping bags that they hang out in, which is why they're called sack spiders. So if you see a little sleeping bag in between the wall and the ceiling of your house, that spider is just hanging out over the winter, and it will leave as soon as spring comes.
I understand there's some spiders that are actually active in the winter. They're out there hunting insects that live in the few warm areas outside. Is that right?
Yeah, mostly, again, they're going to be hanging out underneath the snow in the space between the ground and the snow. So the space builds up because the ground is still warm and it's radiating heat, and then it causes the ice to sublimate, to turn into a gas. It drifts up and refreezes, and so you get a hollow space down there. And there are actually tiny spiders. These are the ones I mostly study that live and even reproduce during the winter, and they live on little insects that are also around in the winter. There's less predation there, so less competition. So there's a small winter community that actually is hanging out every day during the winter.
Do we ever see these? I mean, if they're down under the snow, would us non-spider-studying folk ever run into them?
You probably would not see those ones. There are some other spiders that people do occasionally see in the wintertime, the ones that are just trying to avoid freezing. And what happens is sometimes if it gets too cold, they will be able to sense that they're about to freeze. And then they make a last-ditch effort to get to some place that's safe. And so you'll see a spider sometimes if you go cross-country skiing or something, just sort of walking around on the snow. Most of the time, those probably don't make it. But the other thing I'll mention is there are some flies in Wisconsin that look just like spiders, except, of course, they have six legs. Hmm. They're wingless flies called snow flies.
Wow.
And they actually mate on the snow surface during the winter. So cross-country skiers often tell me about these black spiders they see. Those are actually snow flies.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're making me think about some of these insects and spiders in a
That's
new
good.
Way. And, you know, in our house, I guess it's sort of a spider-friendly house. We don't smush the spiders. My husband is the designated escorter of spiders outside when we find them. But, I mean, do they live if you take them out of your house? Or can they get that antifreeze going in time?
Yeah, the bad news is once it gets to be, you know, wintertime and consistently below freezing, exporting a house spider outside is pretty much a death sentence because they really do need this time to build up the antifreezing compounds, but also because some of those spiders, they don't have any antifreeze compounds, right? Some of those southern spiders. And so, yeah, you would just be killing them, I suppose. Sorry.
It's an invasive species, though, in a way, if you want to think
That's
of it
right.
that
That's right. It
way.
Is. And all of those spiders are all non-native. And so, you know, I guess maybe we feel like they're not really, this is not their place.
Rob,
so,
do
yeah.
you smush them?
I do. Uh-huh. Sometimes I don't want to, but there is a lobby of 13-year-olds in my house that wants them to say. So I would need to make them listen to this. I'm sure they're not.
Yeah.
But, can you persuade us, Mike, to do, what do you do, actually, with spiders in your house?
Well, I got to tell you, we don't touch any of the spiders. They all have free reign in our house. And so I've got a very tolerant wife, and we probably have more cobwebs in the basement than some people do. But, boy, we do not have any insect problems. I never hire any pest control. And we never get bitten, I can tell you that, never.
Interesting. So you're on board. I mean, I suppose one could. Could you theoretically, Mike, collect the spiders, put them in some kind of terrarium, and then I'm trying to make this work, but Rob is laughing
at me. I almost did
a
spit take there, yeah.
Could you collect them, put them in a terrarium, then spring, let them go their happy way?
Yeah, I think that is possible.
you might be able to
keep them in a little quarantine, or maybe keep them in the garage where it doesn't get quite as cold.
Ah, the
like
garage.
That,
yeah. That's a good idea.
No, I'm on board with this.
Rob is laughing at the spider terrarium idea.
Oh, you should totally do that.
Right.
That's a good project for the kids.
I'll keep it in the office.
I support that.
Mike, any spiders in Wisconsin that you wish you knew more about? Ones that you'd want to get more research on and figure out what the heck they're doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my students and I just found a new species of spider, undescribed,
really? Wow.
New to science. And the only place we found it was in the Bay of Green Bay on invasive vegetation. But then we found in a historical collection, we found another one that someone caught in 1975 in the Wolfer River. So I think it's a native species, but we really don't know anything about that species other than it's found in June in Green Bay. So that's one. Yeah, absolutely. We don't even know how many species there are in Wisconsin of spiders to the nearest 100 species. So we know there's 500 species, but there could be 600. Who knows? There could be 700 species. So we don't know very much about most of the species.
Well, Mike, I know you're a scientist, but do you have a favorite spider?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So I study these little tiny spiders called sheet web spiders, and they're pretty endearing because they're too small to bite. They make a little non-sticky horizontal web called a sheet web, and they hang upside down underneath the sheet and attack prey that fall on top of the sheet. And the cool thing about them is the males have these funny-shaped heads. They look like little aliens, and the females are attracted to the head shape of the males of their species. And so that's how they court. And I think they're just fascinating little alien beings.
Oh,
about 2 millimeters long. Yep.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
That is Mike Draney, professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW-Green Bay. And he joined us to share what happens to spiders in Wisconsin in the wintertime.